This time on your weekly constitutional, checks, balances, and impeachment.
What a concept, and what an idea that we should have checks and balances in place, that in the event that these things happen, that we have some safeguards. Imagine if we didn't have any safeguards, and real estate moguls who are involved in foreign powers get into office, and we couldn't do anything about it.
No, not that impeachment, and not that real estate mogul. Instead, we're talking about the very first impeachment in American history. That was University of Tennessee history professor Chris Magra. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about the first impeachment.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
If you happen to find yourself near the Gay Street Bridge in downtown Knoxville, Tennessee, you'll notice a place called Blunt Mansion. If you're curious, you'll walk down Hill Avenue a little bit and you'll see what doesn't really look like a mansion, just a nice old wooden house. But since it was built way back in the 1790s, well, it was a mansion back then. And as the name suggests, it was owned by a man named Blunt. But why is it significant? Why is it, in fact, the only National Historic Site in the county of Knox, not just the city of Knoxville? Well, I have to admit, I passed by many times before I personally investigated, and what I found astounded me. Knoxville, it seems, was the home of a signer of the United States Constitution. Also, a governor of the Southwest Territory, which preceded Tennessee's statehood. Also, the very first person ever to be expelled from the United States Senate.
I'm Chris Magra. I teach colonial American history here at the University of Tennessee. And I specialize in the American Revolution, written two books on it.
What are the titles of your books?
Poseidon's Curse and Fisherman's Cause.
Sounds like they are naval books.
Partly, yeah. And I'm also interested in maritime history.
Right. I don't know if I've ever read a book of maritime history. I'm going to have to pick up one of yours then.
Well, if you love the sea or you love anything surrounding water, you'll love maritime history.
I like seafood.
Okay, that counts.
Very good. We're here today to talk about somebody from this era, from the colonial era, or just shortly thereafter, what we might call the federal period or the constitutional era when our Constitution was forming. His name is William Blunt. Why is William Blunt worthy of our attention today?
William Blunt was born in 1749, died in 1800, and he's the first American politician to be impeached. He's also important regionally here in East Tennessee as the first territorial governor of the region and involved in statehood in 1796. And nationally, he's prominent as a real estate developer, a land speculator, a businessman who's involved in opening the West for expansion for European settlers.
And a signer.
And a signer of the Constitution, absolutely. Member of the American government during the Revolutionary War.
Okay, glad we didn't forget that Constitution part. That's my excuse, you see, to have him on the show. Okay, so he's an important guy, and I should mention that like many Knoxvillians, I was only vaguely aware of him because of his house. There's a place called Blunt Mansion right on the corner of West Hill Avenue and Gay Street, which is right downtown. And there's a big sign out front, Blunt Mansion. The house itself doesn't look like a mansion, not by our standards. It looks almost like a suburban two-story house made of wood. So for years and years, I just sort of drove past it like most Knoxvillians do until finally it got through my thick skull that's on the National Register of Historic Places, the only one in Knox County. And it's there primarily for all the reasons you've just described. He was really an important guy and too often overlooked.
Yeah, I think our local history is so important, and just would encourage all of our listeners to check out the East Tennessee Historical Society along with the Blunt Mansion to learn more about our local history. So many of my students here at UT are unfamiliar with the history of Tennessee, the history of our university, started on land that Blunt donated. Mm-hmm. The Blunt family is very important to our history, and the more we learn about that history, there we'll find lessons there for us today. Many of us had questions about the impeachment of Donald Trump. Many of us thought, you know, the impeachment process either didn't move far enough or was moving too far. And we can look to history, and we can look to people like William Blunt, who was the first American to be impeached, and we can look at his impeachment process for lessons about and perspective on the impeachment process.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, it's in that context that you and I met. Blunt Mansion held a very well-attended evening, simply about William Blunt, the first impeachment, all the rest of it, and I was only a little irritated that your crowd was bigger than the one I had the previous week for something called Impeachment 101.
You have to offer free food. That's
is that what it is?
Yeah,
what it is? Okay.
I think so.
Impeachment 101 really kind of focused on impeachment broadly, of course, including some reference to Blunt. But your talk really focused on Blunt himself, and it was such a great talk.
Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. I enjoyed the heck out of it. You taught me lots of things I didn't know that I thought we'd really have to have you on. So let's start at the beginning. Let's start as early in Blunt's life as you'd like to start, and then let's just bring it forward and tell all about him.
Sure. Well, Blunt is a man who is insatiable when it comes to land. He wants more and more and more land throughout the course of his life. He never stops buying land, even up to the day he dies, and never stops trying to get access to more and more land and open up more and more land to settlers and to real estate developers and speculators. And where does that come from? Where does that desire for more and more come from? Is it a particularly American thing? Is it a function of his business life, as his biographer wants us to believe? Is it natural in us to always want more, to always strive to get more? I think it comes out of his family life growing up in North Carolina, and I think he saw his father first and foremost acquire more land, build more buildings, invest in more businesses. And I think he learned from his dad at an early age that this is something that men do. That to be a man means to acquire things, means to control things. And the more that you acquire, the more important of a man that you are. And Blunt grows up in this environment, and he joins with his brothers, and they form businesses, and they buy more and more land in North Carolina, and they buy land on the frontier.
Land speculation, you said, was it peculiarly American? And my suspicion is that it is. At least to the extent that our founders practiced it. Think about it. Land was the primary source of wealth, that and slaves. And it had been that way for many, many years in Europe, certainly. But there wasn't any land left. And so all those younger sons who'd been disinherited came over here seeking wealth, but they were probably thinking all along, I want some land. And so that was kind of, they were selected for that desire. And many of our founders got involved in land speculation, and many of them failed at it. In fact, I'm thinking of James Wilson, who is the primary author of Article 3 of the Constitution, which established the judiciary and is often considered to be, if not the smartest man at the convention, the second one, maybe after Madison or Hamilton. He ended up on the Supreme Court, running away from debt collectors and periodically finding himself in debtor's prison. So this really was kind of a land fever, wasn't it?
There's a lot of ideas wrapped up in land. Land is part of the American dream. It's part of why people come from different parts of the world. They believe that they can own land and achieve some sort of comfortable independence with that land. And that land will also bring some political status because they can vote and hold elected office here. The belief is that there's land here. But in practice, there are Native Americans on that land. There are Native Americans who control that land. And there are foreign governments who claim ownership over portions of that land. It's not as if North America is a vast, empty continent filled with resources that you just have to come here and buy land and your life is set.
Wait a minute. I thought it was all here. Ordained by God, and the Indians were put here to help us you know, plant fish and corn patches.
Right, absolutely. That's part of the real estate promotion. that a lot of people buy into. I liken it to all the real estate ads you see around Knoxville advertising luxury and freedom associated with this apartment or this condo. And I ask my students to think about, you know, how much freedom would you have if you rented that apartment?
Mm-hmm.
How luxurious would your life actually be if you bought that part? The reality oftentimes is very different than the promotion. And that's the case with land. But it doesn't stop people from coming here. It doesn't stop people from indenturing themselves for 4 to 7 years in the hopes of paying off their passage and then being able and being in a financial position to be able to own land, to buy land on the frontier and settle there. It doesn't stop business owners from investing in real estate companies. It doesn't stop speculators from taking out lines of credit and buying land on the frontier with that credit. It's just a very, very messy process
mm-hmm.
that creates all sorts of complications for people like William Blunt.
And it creates all sorts of conflicts, too, because as you point out, there were people here. In this region, I think it was primarily the Cherokee mm-hmm. and other indigenous tribes, and they certainly had superior claim to the land, but they had inferior numbers and technology, and so there were always those conflicts as the Europeans would push westward, and that's exactly, of course, what Blunt and company were doing. Then that was a problem that had to be addressed.
That's right, and not only are they here, but they're in all the best places to live.
Right.
Because if you've been here for centuries, you figured out which parts of the river have fish in it and which don't. You figured out which lands are fertile and which aren't. And you're reluctant to give that up.
Right. So even if it is comparatively empty, at that point compared to today,
it's less desirable land.
The good parts were filled up. Okay. Yeah. That's good context for all of this. So William Blunt's father in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. is in land speculation mm-hmm. and currency speculation mm-hmm. and all sorts of business deals. Mm-hmm. And I interrupted
and
you.
And he owned slaves.
And, of course, and owned slaves.
And Blunt starts working for his dad as an overseer for these slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's another formative moment for Blunt. The overseer is a particular role on a plantation. They are the drivers of slaves. They are the people whose responsibility is to get as much productivity out of slaves as possible, even to the point of killing them.
Hmm.
And I think that that role teaches Blunt that if you have to go above and beyond, if you have to engage in practices that aren't savory, that other people look at sideways, well, you go ahead and you do it.
It's like a training camp for being ruthless.
I think it was for Blunt in a lot of ways.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with University of Tennessee historian Chris Magra, and he's telling us all about a fellow I call our founding scoundrel, William Blunt. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today we are speaking with Chris Magra, a University of Tennessee historian, all about a fellow I call our founding scoundrel, William Blunt. Before the break, Chris was explaining to me that Blunt got his scoundrelliness naturally through his family and through a job he had early in life. He was actually an overseer for his father's slaves.
That moral compass that a lot of us are raised with, our schools, our churches, our parents, the groups that we associate with, I don't believe that was there for Blunt.
So his morality, whatever there was of it, was almost stripped from him early on in life, and that was over a period of years. And then what did he do after that, after he was an overseer?
He gets involved in the American Revolution. He's a paymaster for North Carolina, and he also has a seat in the Continental Congress at Philadelphia for North Carolina. And he uses his position as paymaster and as a member of the Continental Congress to make business connections outside of North Carolina. He sees this as an opportunity to further his family and his private business ends. I'm going to make these contacts. We're going to create business deals out of this, and I'm going to get a paycheck from the Continental Congress to do all this. And one thing he does while he is involved in the American Revolution is he makes it harder for revolutionary soldiers to collect the land that was owed to them by the American government. The American government was very poor, had very few resources, could not pay its soldiers during the Revolutionary War, and promised them land on the frontier in hopes of creating some buffer between European settlements and Native American settlements.
That's actually a good idea.
That you would have men who've been trained to kill, who know how to fight, and you are now saying, you know, go out there and live. Blunt makes it harder for them. He creates legislation that adds hoops that these veterans have to jump through in order to get their land. He adds so many hoops to the process that soldiers after the war who are financially strapped, who need money to support themselves and their families, are willing to sell their land to speculators like Blunt very cheaply on a dollar.
Oh my, so he wasn't just using his public positions for private gain. He was specifically using them to cheat Revolutionary War veterans out of their promised compensation.
And this was done deliberately.
Oh, my.
And Blunt encouraged his family members to get in on this.
He's sounding like a mafioso here. He also got into a little bit of trouble during the Revolution, didn't he, with that paymaster thing. What was that incident all about?
Yeah, so Blunt's in charge of paying the soldiers from North Carolina that are fighting in the Revolutionary War, and Congress appropriates a sum for him to do this, and on one occasion that sum went missing. It's never accounted for. We don't know what happened to it. Whether it entered into anyone's pockets, we don't know, but it did not enter into the soldiers' pockets who deserved
his other actions, I have to think that there was something nefarious going on. And we're not talking about a small amount of money. We're talking about $300,000. Mm-hmm. I think his excuse was, well, it was the confusion of battle, and it simply got left behind, but no one really knows what happened to it. I certainly wouldn't put it past Blunt to have simply pocketed it.
He's an unsavory character, and you can't get around that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the fascination with Blunt. It's not that he's involved in important moments in U.S. history, like Tennessee becoming a state, like the impeachment process. It's that he is this very controversial figure then and now. And the more you study him, the more controversial he gets. This business with the land and using the government as a platform to further his business doesn't stop in the Revolution. It continues after the Revolution when he's made territorial governor of the region that becomes Tennessee in 1790. George Washington's the first president of the United States.
Well, let's not skip over the convention because that's actually where he met George Washington,
sure,
right?
Sure, sure.
So he's so prominent and he's so powerful. He's from this prominent family. He not only gets sent to the Continental Congress, he later gets sent to the Constitutional Convention of 1787 as the delegate from North Carolina. And while he is there, again, he's looking out for his own interests. And primary among them is getting himself appointed to a position where he will have direct power over North Carolina's western frontier. And a bit of explanation is in order. If you've ever seen a map of the United States from this period, all of the states with western borders on the frontier simply claimed as far west as they could, which typically meant the Mississippi. For example, Virginia claimed what is now Kentucky, and North Carolina claimed what is now Tennessee. But that's a stretch. I mean, it's a long way away. It's across the mountains, all the rest of it. There were already settlers, European settlers out there, but there was such a distance and such difficulty getting back and forth. Maybe it was unrealistic for North Carolina to think it was going to keep Tennessee all this time. So a deal was worked out that North Carolina ceded that property to the United States government, I think in exchange for forgiveness of their debts, right? Okay, in the Revolution. Mm-hmm. So now you've got something called the Southwest Territory.
Because what better way to get access to frontier lands, to be able to buy that land, to develop it, and to move settlers in and sell land to those settlers on 200-acre homesteads? What better way to do that than if you're the territorial governor?
Oh, man.
What a plum position to be in that role as governor, to be in negotiations with indigenous peoples, to create treaties with Native Americans that would establish borders that may or may not move over time, that you may or may not violate over time, and to know what lands are available, than to be territorial governor. And he is. Washington names him as territorial governor, part because he's a real estate developer, and he has knowledge of these lands, in part because he has had dealings in the past with indigenous peoples, although not favorable for indigenous peoples, and in part also as a political reward, Blunt is a diehard Federalist.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of businessmen, like a lot of large landowners, shortly after the Revolution, they are ardent supporters of a stronger national government.
Right.
That we need to move away from a confederation of states in which the states are sovereign and to a federation.
And in Blunt's view, that's because there are fewer people he has to bribe and ingratiate himself to get to a position of power. Yeah, that's in fact the Federalists were one of the major parties, the first ones we had here, and Hamilton was probably the leader of it, though Washington was probably effectively the first leader, though he denied it. And then opposite them were the what I like to call the Jeffersonians, because their name is actually really confusing. They called themselves the Democratic Republicans, mm-hmm. often referred to as Republicans, but has no relationship to the later Republican Party and precious little to the modern Democratic Party.
Yes.
Nonetheless, the Jeffersonians, led by Jefferson and Madison eventually, were more of the states' rights people. And they wanted power to be closer to the people, and they didn't like people like William Blunt. So please, pick it up from there.
So Blunt becomes a territorial governor, and Tennessee moves for statehood in 1796. So a region has to have a certain population level before they can apply to the United States government to become a state. They do this in 1796, and Federalists, like George Washington, oppose the statehood of Tennessee. And this rubs Blunt the wrong way. And this is part of the complex origins of Blunt's later impeachment in 1797. Blunt moves into the anti-Federalist or Democratic Republican or Jeffersonian camps, whatever mm-hmm. we want to call it. He's angry at the Federalists for opposing the statehood of Tennessee. And they oppose it in part because they don't want to get embroiled in conflicts with Native American groups. Just like the British government in 1763 that passed a proclamation proposing the Appalachian Mountain Range as a boundary beyond which European settlers couldn't go, it's not a humanitarian effort. The Federalists in the 1790s and the British government in the 1760s isn't trying to preserve an indigenous way of life. They just don't want to pay the costs of wars with indigenous people.
Something just occurred to me, Chris. You're talking about, of course, the line of demarcation in 1763, and this created a problem for a fellow we've been hearing about. George Washington fought in what we call the French and Indian War, which was sort of a sideshow to the Seven Years' War, and he, as a veteran, was promised lands to the west, actually bordering on the Ohio River in what's now West Virginia. And was incensed when King George III then said, no, you're not going to be able to take those lands because I've just drawn a line in the sand and you can't cross it. So back in the day, George Washington was the land speculator
yep.
who was angry at a government that was not going to allow him to speculate and move west. Now you're telling me, and just a few years later,
yeah.
a few
right.
decades later, George Washington is
That's
the one
right.
who's trying to draw his own line of demarcation and saying to people like Blunt, stay away from the natives.
That's right. And some of our most prominent Americans are involved in real estate speculation. This is not run by fly-by-night organizations. This is not something that the typical businessman in America gets involved in. These are the elites of the elites in America. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, that own multiple plantations, hundreds of slaves. They're getting involved in these real estate companies that are speculating in lands on the frontier, that they are financially hurt by the 1763 proclamation line. And then when they get into power as presidents,
do the same thing. I got mine, so the heck with you.
You know, the frontier is a source of contention. While land ownership is an American ideal, while it's linked to freedom, while it's linked to democracy and political power, it's also a source of problems throughout American history.
One other example that's slightly off topic, but we'd mention him too, was Jefferson. most people know about Monticello, maybe even visited, and I encourage them to. But most people have not heard of Poplar Forest, which is a mini version of Monticello out close to Roanoke, Virginia. Now, that's pretty far west, especially for Thomas Jefferson's time. But even he was buying up all these western lands, and he was using it and building this elaborate house that way. So everybody who was anybody was in on it.
That's right. And it's not a simple matter. Anyone who owns a home today who's tried to get an addition put on their home,
right,
just their own home, just a small addition, knows that it can be an ordeal, let alone trying to buy hundreds of thousands, if not millions of acres on the frontier to develop that land and to sell it. The problems associated with that are huge. The risks are many, but it's the financial payoff at the end of the day. The cultural significance of being a large landowner in America is such, there's so much status associated with it, that people like William Blunt just go all in.
So when he shows up as territorial governor, this was what, 1796?
So he's governor in 1790.
79,
Tennessee,
excuse me.
He becomes a state in 1796, and he's elected as the first, one of the earliest senators.
You were getting ahead of ourselves. So I want to hear about this. So in 1790, he is appointed the territorial governor. That's only 3 years after the Constitution's been written and signed. So very early appointment by George Washington. Mm-hmm. And so he packs his bags, and he comes west. Along the way, in far eastern Tennessee, he shows up and he starts telling people, I'm your new governor. Mm-hmm. And how does he convince them of this, other than showing them a document that purports to have George Washington's signature on it?
Right. Well, Blunt is known in this part of the country. There's not a lot of settlers here. It's not as if in 1790 this is teeming with European settlers. It's a relatively small community. John Sevier, for example, is one of the prominent settlers who knows William Blunt, and the two develop a friendship over the years. And even when John Sevier is governor of Tennessee, they have a strong friendship. Even when Blunt is impeached, John Sevier protects him.
Right.
It's not as if Blunt is coming into this part of the world and he has to do a lot to establish his credentials.
And he basically starts handing out largesse, doesn't he?
He starts
appointing people.
That helps. That helps.
If you show up with a document, I might not believe you, but mm-hmm. if you show up with money
right,
and prestigious,
you appoint me to a position, yes.
Then all of a sudden,
I'm all in.
Exactly,
yeah.
I'm all in on that.
Yeah.
And so, okay, very, very interesting. So he shows up, and he does some good things. I mean, he signs this Treaty of the Holston with the Cherokee, which at least addresses some of the sources of conflict between them, if it doesn't solve them.
Well, but the Holston line is one of the most controversial things in Blunt's life, because he sets a border and then he tries to work around that border, and he allows settlers to move past that border, and then he renegotiates that line. Once you set a line in the sand, and once you get surveyors to go out and map wherever you think this border should be, that in and of itself is an untenable situation. Unless you physically build some structure. I don't know, maybe a wall. I don't know what that physical structure would look like. Unless you build something, people aren't going to be able to see on a daily basis, well, this is the border. This is the line. This is where we should be. You can make it a river. You can make it a mountain. And even if you do that, people are going to say, well, can I settle on the other side of the river? What if it's just on the bank? What if it's on this foothill of this mountain? Can I do that?
Right.
People are always going to push the limits of wherever you say there's a boundary line, especially when it's something that covers a large territory.
And so he was not above pushing those lines back.
Not one bit. Not one bit.
And that actually made him extremely popular among the European settlers,
yes,
right?
Yes.
He was clearly on their side and clearly was willing to stretch the truth and violate promises so that they could also become landowners, and they in turn gave him their enthusiastic political support.
That's equally true. And part of Blunt's popularity, part of his fame, is that he fought for the interests of European settlers on the frontier. He didn't fight for Native Americans and their interests and their control over the land. people who lived on the frontier felt as though their lives were insecure. They felt that at any moment they could be attacked, and they're always demanding government support. And at different moments, the government will provide them with some form of support, but other times they won't. And here's Blunt, who is championing their interests at the local, at the state, and even at the national levels. And so people in Tennessee, especially once Tennessee becomes a state in 1796, there's some love for William Blunt here because of that. Now, there's also folks that he screwed over in business deals who are here who don't love him. He's not beloved by everyone in the state of Tennessee. He's not beloved by everyone in America. But there's a segment of people on the frontier who feel like he's fighting for them.
Okay. So there he is fighting for them. And meanwhile, as you've mentioned before, Blunt starts buying up millions and millions of acres, he and his family. It was a family enterprise. And the value of that acreage, to a great extent, correct me if I'm wrong, depended upon access to waterways, which, of course, is the highway by which a farmer is going to take his produce to market. Mm-hmm. And the waterways on that side of the mountains, they drain to the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And so the Mississippi becomes extremely important to any Western land speculator, and especially to Blunt. Mm-hmm. What happens with regard to the Mississippi that makes him and other speculators panic?
Well, this is the wild thing about William Blunt. He and his family own over 3 million acres of land. I don't know about you. I grew up on 3 acres of land in Pennsylvania. I mowed over 2 of those acres of grass, mm-hmm. and that's more grass than I ever want to mow for my life.
Right.
I don't even know what 3 million acres of land looks like, but Blunt wanted more. He's not satisfied with that. So he uses his position as a United States senator, right? Tennessee elects him as one of her first senators, 1796. He's in the United States Senate.
Just pause. Blunt did play a very important role in the drafting of the brand new Constitution for the state of Tennessee.
Yes.
Much of that happened right at or around Blunt Mansion.
That's in here in Knoxville.
Right here in Knoxville. So that's the part we don't want to skip over completely. Yep. And along with John Sevier and other prominent Tennesseans, he shepherds the state into an existence in 1796.
Yep.
And so one of the first orders of business once you're a new state is electing or selecting, the legislature selects 2 United States senators on staggered terms because they're starting simultaneously. And William Blunt is one of the 2 selected by the legislature of the state of Tennessee. So everything's looking good, right?
And because the way you get ahead in business, the way that you get ahead in real estate is to get involved in politics mm-hmm. and to get into these positions of power where you have knowledge and access to all of this land.
This is your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today, my guest is Chris Magra, a historian from the University of Tennessee, and he's telling us all about a fellow I call our founding scoundrel, William Blunt. And now let's finish our discussion with Chris Magra, a UT historian, who's been telling us all about William Blunt. It turns out that Blunt, indeed his whole family, made a career out of gaining political power only to use it for their own benefit.
And so Blunt is always climbing. He's entering into local politics, into state politics, into national politics. He's always going up and up and up to get more and more land, and it's never enough. And so he's elected senator, and he uses his position as a United States senator to meet with...
Wait a minute. Before we say what he did, why did he do it? Why was he concerned about the Mississippi?
Yes.
It was... The Spanish controlled it, right? And the Spanish had been letting our commerce go by in New Orleans, right? And they owned several... They owned much of Florida, and they owned up and down the Mississippi River. So no problemo. But it looked as if, because of events over in Europe... that maybe the French would soon be taking it over. And how were relations between the United States and France in the 1790s?
During the French Revolution, there's a controversy in America over whether we should support the French in their revolution. Mm-hmm. A lot of their revolutionaries have fought over here in America for our independence, were inspired by our independence. So you would think a lot of Americans would support the French in their revolution. But we're just starting out. We're a new nation. We don't have a large military, and we don't really want a large military. And the idea of getting involved, well, how involved should we get, and how much is that going to cost, and what are the repercussions of getting involved in this? Because Britain could return at any minute and attack us if we support France.
And so relations between us and France got pretty fraught.
Very messy, very messy. The French Revolution is another context for William Blunt's eventual impeachment. It's wrapped up in the politics of this. It's wrapped up in William Blunt seeing New Orleans and also seeing Florida as this zone of possibility, mm-hmm. right? That's out there. It's messy. It's complex. It's the Wild West. Anything could happen. What if a United States senator took advantage of that? What if a United States senator was able to create a scenario in which the United States of America could take Florida and could take control over New Orleans, and taking New Orleans would give control over the Mississippi River? And oh boy, once we controlled the Mississippi River, the whole West would be open to real estate development and settlement.
So his own property values would skyrocket.
And the potential would be limitless.
Limitless.
You're talking about the middle of the country. Now, you're not just talking about the frontier
right.
along the what could be considered the east, although it's west of the Appalachian Mountain.
Right.
Now you're talking about the interior of a continent. And you're talking about one man visualizing all this.
Right. So he was visionary. It was just always visioning of money in his own pockets. Okay, so in some he's got an idea, and in some level it makes sense. But you were about to tell me how he was actually going to
implement. I don't know at any level that makes sense, right? How many of us sit around thinking, you know, if we could just take over this portion of the continent.
Wait a minute. Didn't you ever play Risk as a boy?
Absolutely.
Okay,
oh,
well,
yes.
That's
oh,
when
yes.
I started thinking about world conquest.
Yeah.
Okay.
I never actually thought about doing it, though.
Uh-huh, okay.
You know, I enjoyed playing those games with my brother and his friends.
Absolutely. All right, then. So William Blunt has this idea, but he's got to implement it. So how is what's going to be eventually called the Blunt Conspiracy? What's that look like?
Yes. So 1797, Blunt is a United States senator, and he's in Philadelphia. And he's meeting with individuals. A minor English minister is over in Philadelphia to conduct foreign relations with the United States government. There's also a frontiersman, a man who had worked for Blunt before, kind of opening Western lands and helping to develop them and install roads and those kind of things. He's known for having contacts with Native American groups. And he gets with Blunt along with the English minister, and they begin to create this vision of using white European settlers on the frontier with Native American groups who are willing to ally with this cabal, conspiracy, this group, whatever we want to call them.
Mm-hmm.
And the British Navy is going to help and be involved in this process as well.
Oh, my. So Blunt is actually planning on using American settlers. Native Americans as well. I don't know, maybe getting back in control over some of those Tennessee militias he commanded when he had been governor. You know, there's military force out there, and he'd been in charge of them previously. So they're going to march west and south, and they're going to attack New Orleans and attack New Madrid, I believe it's pronounced now, and possessions along the Gulf Coast, while the British fleet shows up on the other side.
And provides them support from the ocean.
So they're going to squeeze the Spanish out.
And of course, this is all going to work.
What could possibly go wrong?
And Blunt will come out of this looking fantastic. We've added new territory to the United States Empire, and who better to control these regions than the man who was responsible for taking it all? The problem is that all of this is highly illegal.
There's that.
The United States government has not sanctioned this one bit. And there's Blunt kind of working behind the scenes. And also, by this time, remember, friends, he is an ardent anti-federalist.
Mm-hmm.
He is speaking out against the United States government. He's speaking out about John Adams, who's president of the United States in 1796. He's attacking Adams. He's attacking George Washington. Again, because they oppose Tennessee becoming a state, he's an outspoken anti-federalist. And so you have these different contexts at play. And then Blunt trusts a letter outlining his plan to take Florida and New Orleans and outlining his plan to use Native American allies to negotiate independently of the United States government with Great Britain and with these different Native American groups who constitute foreign powers. The Native American groups are not members of the United States government. And so he puts all this in a letter. And he trusts it.
Full stop. Note to self, if you're right. conspiring.
Right. If you're playing Risk and you're thinking of taking of territory, don't write that down.
Don't write it down. Oh, my gosh.
And he trusts it to a dude who delivers it into the wrong hands, and it makes its way all the way to Philadelphia and gets into John Adams' hands.
And a little bit of Knoxville history. It was actually captured near the Knoxville blockhouse, or the Tellico blockhouse, which is to the west of Knoxville, right? Mm-hmm. That's where the letter changed hands and ultimately then made its way to Washington, to Philadelphia, which was our capital at that time. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Blunt's there. He's in Philadelphia. Yep. And then on a fateful day, he's going into the Senate after
July
having
July in 1797.
He's just taking a walk, and he comes back from his walk, and what does he encounter?
So Blunt is not even a United States senator for a year, friends. Let's remember that. One of the first senators from Tennessee, he's not even in office a year. And John Adams, the president, gets a hold of this letter, and he feels like as though a crime has been committed here. He feels as though this isn't just business as usual. This isn't typical American business. John Adams, the president of the United States, feels a crime's been committed, and he gets with his attorney general, and the attorney general looks it over and is convinced that an actual crime has been committed, that there is some conspiracy with foreign powers against the interests of the United States government going on here. And John Adams sends the letter to the United States Senate and argues that they should work to impeach Blunt. And there's a little bit of a faux pas here. Adams should not have done this. Adams was wrong to send that letter to the Senate, and he's wrong, constitutionally speaking, he's wrong to have pushed for the Senate to do something on the basis that Blunt had committed a crime. Not 5 days after Adams does this, the Senate votes to expel Blunt from the Senate.
Okay, and the reason there's a constitutional problem is because impeachment is the sole province of the House
of
Representatives.
It's supposed to start there with
right.
them.
Okay, so he did kind of start off in the wrong direction, even if ultimately he was right that Blunt should be out. Okay, so now the Senate decides to simply expel Blunt.
Yep.
Do they actually hold a trial before they do that, or they simply...
No, so they don't. This is not... We're not even to the impeachment yet.
Right, okay.
The Senate just acts on the basis of the president sending them this letter and the attorney general's recommendation that a crime has been committed, and they vote to expel Blunt. The House of Representatives then starts the impeachment process, and they signal that Blunt is going to be impeached after the fact that he's been expelled.
Okay.
And this creates some procedural issues down the road that are going to play up in 1799 during his actual impeachment trial. Mm-hmm. So then the Senate, after they've expelled him, receives this recommendation from the House of Representatives that he is to be impeached, and they set the trial date. His actual impeachment trial starts in December of 1798. His trial concludes in 1799.
Okay.
Spring of 1799.
And it was a big event. In fact, his Jeffersonian allies provided him with a defense. Jefferson himself provided him with a defense. And so that was quite a spectacle, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a spectacle. Over the course of 1797 and 1798, the Federalists drag William Blunt through the mud. They personally attack him. And regardless of what you think about the President of the United States, imagine the President of the United States talking publicly about you in such a way that is embarrassing, in such a way that is scandalous, in such a way that your family honor is at stake. William Blunt faces this impeachment process over the course of 2 years.
Okay. And so the House did impeach him, mm-hmm. and that's why we say this is the first impeachment. And then they went over to the Senate for the trial, right? So the Senate that's already expelled him is now trying him.
And those of our listeners who didn't hear your impeachment process talk, impeachment just means we're at the start.
Right, we're accusing someone.
We are accusing someone. Impeachment doesn't mean that you are kicking someone out of office.
Okay, so they basically just screwed up the whole process the very first time out.
It's the first time. Maybe we give them a pass.
We have to give them a pass. No, the way it's supposed to work is that the House considers evidence to decide whether they wish to accuse a federal official of a high crime or misdemeanor or bribery or something of that sort. And, you know, they can hold their hearings.
Well, that's the thing, too. Bribery, treason,
or high crime
or misdemeanor.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, bribery and treason are fairly straightforward, but that high crimes and misdemeanors part is what
there's
we're—
There's a lot of interpretation built into that.
Jerry Ford, the one-time leader of the House minority and then later president of the United States, was actually once trying to impeach a Supreme Court justice. And he was asked, you know, what high crime or misdemeanor has this fellow committed? And he said, well, a high crime or misdemeanor is whatever the House of Representatives says it is at any given point in history. And in a purely technical sense, he's right. So the House eventually gets around to doing the process properly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They send a recommendation to the Senate. They actually have a Senate trial. But is Blunt convicted in that Senate trial?
So Blunt is acquitted. His defense team puts forward five different defenses, one of which is, you already got rid of this guy. He's not actually a senator here, so you have no jurisdiction.
There's a bit of a point to that.
there's a problem here. One of the other components of their defense is that congressmen, House of Representatives, or members of the Senate don't fall under the category civil officers. So the impeachment article in the Constitution focuses on the president, the vice president, or civil officers.
Like federal judges.
And that comes out of Blunt's trial, the Senate trial, that from then on, from 1799 on, members of Congress can't be impeached.
That's an extremely important point. Yeah. Recently, I believe our current president, Trump, suggested that Mitt Romney should be impeached.
Now, it's not constitutional. He's got to amend the Constitution of the United States to do that.
Right. Romney is a sitting United States senator and was no more impeachable than William Blunt was. And most constitutional scholars will agree with this interpretation because impeachment is perhaps the ultimate check that Congress as a whole has on the other two branches of government. And it doesn't make sense for the House to vote to impeach somebody in the Senate. Think about that. Then that senator would be a juror in his own impeachment trial. It just doesn't make sense. And so that established the precedent. So a very important part of this comes out. So
it's important to remember, too, that the impeachment process is an important element of our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That no one is above the law in this country.
Right.
Our founding fathers who created the Constitution did not want tyrants in any form.
No.
Did not want to have people in power stay in power regardless of what they did. They're afraid that that's going to happen. They recognize that people are fallible. Mm-hmm. People are likely to become corrupt when they get into positions of power. And they create a system of checks and balances that are supposed to institutionally protect us from tyrants. So we shouldn't hate on the impeachment process.
No.
We should view the impeachment process as a safeguard for our democracy.
Absolutely. It's a very important part of our system of checks and balances. Okay. So Blunt is not actually convicted, and he's not removed through the impeachment process, but the Senate has already expelled him, which is within its authority. So he's back in Tennessee, and of course, completely disgraced, right?
You would think so, wouldn't you? You would think that after 2 years of President of the United States dragging your name through the mud, you would think that he would be a disgraced politician. But remember that he's back in Tennessee. Remember, friends, that there are people in the United States in 2019 and 2020 who don't really take the impeachment process seriously. Remember, there are some of your neighbors out there today who are saying, you know, this is just a political thing that some politicians are trying to make a name for
themselves. Or they say it's an unconstitutional coup.
Yes.
It's the most constitutional thing that the Congress can do.
Right. And so there are people in Tennessee not all Tennesseans, but there are people in Tennessee who are saying this is an Eastern matter. This is a matter for Federalists in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and this is just a political thing. And so Blunt actually has something of a political career. He gets elected to the Senate in Tennessee while he's being impeached at the federal level.
So he's put into the state government again here in the state of Tennessee.
He's back in the state government.
Okay.
And from a business perspective, he doesn't stop investing in lands on the frontier throughout all of this. He goes bankrupt. He owes more than he can pay, and he continues to take out lines of credit. He finds people who are willing to give him credit on his family name, and he takes out credit to buy lands on the frontier, continues speculating up until the day he dies.
All right. So let me summarize then. You have a real estate mogul mm-hmm. who gains high office, who enlists the assistance of a foreign power to interfere
in... I see where you're going with this.
U.S. I'm just summarizing. Now, this is all history. This is all history.
Yes.
In U.S. foreign affairs and national security issues, a process for his own personal gain.
It's all true, friends.
Leading George Washington to say this is the blackest of crimes and that all good men should detest William Blunt. And, of course, the House of Representatives agreed it was eminently impeachable, and the Senate probably would have convicted him. This is me speculating, except for the fact they'd already basically booted him. What a concept.
What a concept, right? What a concept, and what an idea that we should have checks and balances in place, that in the event that these things happen, that we have some safeguards. Imagine if we didn't have any safeguards, and real estate moguls who are involved in foreign powers get into office and we couldn't do anything about it. Imagine a political system like that, friends.
I believe that's called a dictatorship. And we've seen lots and lots of those reemerging across this great world of ours lately. Okay, any final thoughts, Chris? This has been a fascinating tale. What do you take from it?
Well, I take that history is important. And I take that there are lessons and perspectives from the past. History's not dead. History is alive. It matters today. We all need to learn it. And the more that we learn it, the more we study it, the less we'll repeat it.
Well, I certainly hope so, at least in some cases. But Chris Magra of the University of Tennessee, this has been wonderful, and I very much appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to University of Tennessee history professor Chris Magra. Wasn't he just fantastic? Thanks also to my good buddy Greg Hill over at WUOT in Knoxville, who very generously gave us studio time and even sat through the interview. In fact, if you listen real close, you can hear Greg chortling along from time to time. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment where no one is above the law.